Can you guys come in closer?
Yeah.
Don't be shy. If there's anywhere big red in case anybody's far away.
Yeah.
Is it hot?
Maybe we need some big red.
Seems to be. Big red. It seems
to go.
To
get a little closer
to
that.
Oh,
maybe we can even get rid of some of that excess chairs and all. Oh, okay. Kyle, can I sit by you, man?
Yeah.
And anybody can sit over my recorder. Don't be afraid of it. But you can tell it. Well, you should turn it off. But I'll tell you my intention.
What do you think your coffee was?
Yeah, Kyle, that's all good.
I guess I'm mad about it.
Okay. Is that everyone? Do we have any more people here? Okay.
Yeah, she's very popular.
Well, actually, I'm hoping we can all get sort of as close as possible so we can really have a kind of intimate conversation. So you people who are way over there at the head, just come on in a little bit. Let's all really be able to see each other. Feel like we can throw spitballs. By the way, this is, you know, all forms of expression are welcome to, including spitballs, gestures.
Yeah, he does moving in.
Okay. Have we fit everyone? We have one. We have an excluded person. That's in a circle. But unless you choose to be, if you choose to be.
I think that was the choice.
Yeah? Okay, that's my choice.
My choice? You guys don't want to use
that. What?
Okay, hello, everyone. My name is Lex, and I've invited you all here to have a conversation on words and revolution. I want to check about one thing with everyone first. I make sound art I have conversations, and I take those conversations, and I sort of mutilate them and cut them up and recombine them, and I'm hoping that it's okay with everyone here if I make a recording of this conversation, and then I may do something with it later. Okay, good. So that's the first thing. And so I'm hoping that this is actually going to be a conversation from very soon, not necessarily just a presentation. I have nothing to present at all, although in order to have an instrument for the conversation, I brought along a text that we could go through. But maybe we could just start with sort of introductions really quick so that we all know each other's names and so that we can really be closer, a little bit closer. So I'm Lex, that's all.
I'm Chris.
Kathleen.
Claude.
Rachel.
Mike, can we be a circle?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Ideally, we should be. Or an oval. But we should all be able to see each other well. Or they can stand at the distance and watch from afar.
And spit.
Yeah. So you're Dave? No.
I could be. I'm Mike right now.
Mike.
I'm Andre.
I'm Chavo.
I'm Royce.
Royce?
Yes.
I'm Sandra.
Betsy.
Dory.
Seth.
I'm Dave.
Carl.
Kyle.
And has everyone gotten a text or could get a text? There's one more left. Maybe we can give Dave a text. Yeah, can we just pass it over to him?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So, I don't know if are any of you poets, writers? Is everyone here sort of a poet or a writer or something? Yeah. Okay, so I feel like then that's good, because we can think about our sort of special sacred role, sacred, if that's okay to use words like that, in the shaping and use of words and our own reflections on what's going on with words in this moment in time where it seems like something is going on with words, right? Does anybody have a feeling that words don't mean what they used to mean? Anything like that? Yeah? No? That's my own. So, so in order to discuss that, I thought we could look at something written from the 60s, which was looking at the role of poets in revolutionary language, and maybe just go through each one and sort of react to them and follow any tangents that may come up.
What's the source?
It's what?
The source.
Yeah, that's the... We're going to be reading, Jerome Rothenberg, and this is published in his anthology Prefaces, which is just an anthology of sort of chapter prefaces of his different other poetry anthologies.
And so these three pages are just...
They're
from that...
Yeah, they were from a
they're
from a talk that he gave at Long Island University at a symposium called Revolutions and Revolutionaries in Literature, and that was in 1966 at Long Island University. So Alec can read the first one, and maybe should we go around, or should somebody just volunteer to read the next one? Okay. So, number one, a revolution involves a change in structure. A change in style is not a revolution.
A revolution in poetry or painting or music is part of a total revolutionary pattern. Modern art is fundamentally subversive. Its thrust is toward an open-ended, continuous revolution.
Any form, whatever, by the mere fact that it exists as such and endures, necessarily loses vigor and becomes worn. To recover vigor, it must be reabsorbed into the formless, if only for an instant. It must be restored to the primordial unity from which it issued. In other words, it must return to chaos on the cosmic plane, or to orgy on the social plane, to darkness for seed, to water, baptism on the human plane, Atlantis on the plane of history, and so on.
The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is natural manure. Without contraries, there is no progression. Attraction and repulsion, reason and energy, love and hate are necessary to human existence.
Do you have the original there in front of you? Because it gets cut off.
It does?
You could finish reading it for us here.
Number five is not there?
It
gets cut off on the next sheet.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Where is that? Oh, my God. I'm sorry. I didn't see that until... Thank you for pointing that out.
If we can just...
Yeah.
So, it is possible to rationalize the history of modern poetry or art to mask its subversive character. But even as fad and fashion, order, as it builds the shadow... shadow something.
Can I read number five again?
Yes, please.
It is possible to rationalize the history of modern poetry or art to mask its subversive character. But even as fad and fashion, poetry continues to subvert, to destroy the constructs of an old order as it builds the shadow constructs of a new one.
Okay. Can we just take a second and write that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But even as fad and fashion, poetry...
Poetry continues to subvert, to destroy the constructs of an old order. And then you have, as it builds the shadow constructs of a new one.
As it builds the what? The shadow?
As it builds the shadow constructs of a new one.
Is there a name attached to that or no?
No, it's not a quote.
Okay.
The development of the five senses is the work of the entire history of the world up till now. Come.
The change in vision is a change in form. The change in form is a change of reality.
The poet's function is to spread doubt and create illusion from end chaos.
Revolutions are preceded and accompanied by a breakdown in communication.
Long-lived societies, even where rooted in social injustice, will survive as long as groups that should be in conflict share a common language, i.e. a common system of values, an ascribed meaning, a common religion, mythology, etc.
I think this is when it's going to get cut off again.
Really?
I think three is
it there? Oh, because no, four is just
the
one that's not there. Okay.
We don't have to talk before.
Where change mobility becomes so rapid as to make it impossible for the language to change commensurately. This common language begins to break down, and groups of men, while using the same words, no longer understand each other.
Mm. I guess I'll read four then. This breakdown of communication is first articulated by a poet and carried on by other poets.
Say again.
This breakdown in communication is first articulated by a poet and carried on by other poets.
Non-poets freely adapt a language of poetry, even where they fail to understand it, to provide them with a revolutionary form of communication. They soon come to consider it their own invention. Nope, this is the history of Christianity and the French and Russian Revolution. Just so you know.
The poet sees the breakdown in communication as a condition of health, as an opening up of the closed world of the old order. He carries the revolution of language and form into the new society of the political revolutionaries.
The political revolutionary sees the breakdown in communication as further evidence of the malaise of the old order and dedicates himself to the re-establishment of a closed system he or those he speaks for can control. The demand for closure extends to the work of the poet.
The confrontation between poet and political revolutionary moves towards a showdown that the poet seems fated to lose. But their lasting union would signal a turning of history and the reconstitution of man in Eden. Note, the sign of the communal paradise will be that all the languages now spoken by man will have been made obsolete. This is the prophecy of Apollinaire.
Okay. That's it.
Is he a situationist?
Is what?
It just says like it's a collage of propositions. It's very situationist-y.
Well, it was the 60s. I don't know
okay,
if he's particularly situationist. He definitely like read the letterists and all of them, but I don't think he was particularly situationist. Do you want to know about the author?
Yeah.
Yeah. Jerome Rothenberg was an ethnopoeticist. So he did a lot of. He got involved with translation of Native American poetries and then got into the whole ideas of what translation of Native American poetry meant. In the 60s, there were a lot of people sort of associated with the movement of ethnopoetics that were mostly in the West. A lot of people were in the Western United States or were anthropologists with an interest in poetry and the song structures of different people they met. Gary Snyder was very influential in this movement. And so through the process of trying to translate Native American and other indigenous poetries, which are kind of song structures into written English, it just caused a rethinking of their whole idea of what poetry was, and also the relation between poetry and song, and poetry and written poetry and vocality, and recording was going on at that time. Like the beginning of sound poetry was going on at that time. Not the beginning, but there was an activity, and so that led into a whole rethinking about orality, A-U-R-A-L-I-T-Y as well, in poetry. So that's the author. Any thoughts, first round thoughts from anyone? Any of the propositions pique anything?
Well, my thought was that if there are too many words, then I guess they start to lose their meaning.
What do you mean by too many words? What is that? What are too many words?
You think that's why words end up losing their meaning? Because there are too many?
You might not mean too many in vocabulary so much as a profusion of,
right.
of words. And I think that makes a bit more sense in saying there are too many words and so they begin to lose their meaning. Or not that they lose their meaning, but they get away from us and they start to do something beyond our intent with them.
But so the breakdown is a profusion, you think?
It's a loss of understanding of meaning, mm-hmm. and then that leads to profusion, which leads to further breakdown.
Mm-hmm. Should we go back to the breakdown? Can I read that one once more, and then see what we think about the breakdown? Okay. Long-lived societies, even where rooted in social injustice, will survive as long as groups that should be in conflict share a common language, that is, a common system of values and ascribe meaning, a common religion, mythology. Where change becomes so rapid as to make it impossible for the language to change commensurately, this common language begins to break down, and groups of men, while using the same words, no longer understand each other. It seems like this is like definitely going on right now, where, just to use like the most obvious word, democracy, there is absolutely no way that like the word democracy can be having a shared meaning. I mean, there really are. I recently met some, there were Arabs from, they were like visiting the UN, you know, they were involved in some kind of NGO, from the NGO sector, you know, and they were talking about the distinction between Bush and the democracy thing, like that they were pro-democracy. They were just anti-Bush and anti-aggression, but they were pro-democracy, and like, I was trying to understand what on earth they meant by democracy, you know, as if democracy didn't just mean some kind of empty, vague word that means incorporation into like the... Like, to me, democracy now just means incorporation into Deutsche Bank, Citibank, the world financial complex. Like, your government is part of that singular financial system.
So American imperialist capitalism.
I think American imperialist would be oversimplification. Why do you think it's American imperialist? It doesn't lead to London and Berlin just as assuredly,
sure.
or even Delhi or Hong Kong, as clearly as it does to New York. You know? Why is it American? The army is American, definitely. The army that protects all the oil boats is American. It's their navy.
The imperialism that began in Iran, let's say, was British, right? That came from the Brits when they first there. So it's not necessarily just American, although that is very strongly
mm-hmm.
what we're dealing with today
mm-hmm.
in the more obvious way.
We can see the continuance of imperialism at the same time as the decline of America. I mean, it can change hands
yes.
seamlessly, I think. So.
Like America could just fall, but the imperial structure isn't
for sure.
And
yeah.
China
yeah.
or just a
something else
bank government or something
yeah.
and uses the structures that are over there.
Yeah, like the ruling class that's in America could easily just move to London, like next, or secede Colorado. They'll sort of all move to Aspen, and Colorado will become an autonomous republic protected by some.
And they could do it partially because of language, because the words. You said that there are too many words, so they lose their meaning. At the same time, if you don't have enough words, they take on too much meaning. Like word, like democracy doesn't have the shared thing, so anyone can fill the void. The word is there waiting for people to kind of just
mm-hmm.
move in, like, well, now it means this. There's room for us. We crowded them out, now it means this. And so it allows kind of a seamless continuation of power where people talk about it as if it's the same thing even though it's changing.
I'm also interested, too, in how common language here, referring back to what we were just reading, involves common system of values ascribed mm-hmm. to meaning, common religion and mythology. Now, common language, if you were to just think about it just off the cuff. Like, I would never say common language equals, you know, a common system of values, for sure,
mm-hmm.
or common religion or mythology, right? The language is the tool, in a way, to describe the commonalities that may exist across these other spheres,
mm-hmm.
right? But, and it's also the tool of translation, to translate between, you know, languages of mythology, languages of religion, language of values, language of
But you're finding it problematic to equate a common language with common values?
No, to mean that common language means or implies a common system of values
mm-hmm.
and common religion and mythology.
Because
right. it's not really all-inclusive of those things. It's actually the tool that translates across those things, perhaps.
So then, I mean, if that's true, like, there's almost, like, only the possibility for subcultural societies. Like, there is no possibility
right.
for a long-lived monarchy. There's only, like, cults and little apocalyptic cults that will,
and maybe that's precisely what like we should take from reading it in a sense, right?
If we agree
that we're
it.
Not going to be a long-lived society.
Yeah, I don't know. What do people think of that? But like, if for a society to be long-lived, we have to have a common language, which means common values. If there's no possibility within modernity,
yeah.
is there a possibility within modernity for a common language at all, or is there just like always war then?
Well,
of redefining our words and...
Depends what you mean by language.
I do think that professions tend to have their own language, you know, like lawyers have a language.
I was thinking
the chemists have a language, biologists have a language.
I'm going to change tacks a little bit, but I think I don't think of language as a tool that we use to describe our world. I think of it as a thing that constructs how we can conceive of our world. So it's much more powerful than just a shovel. It's like we invent words.
Right.
Well, we invent words to be able to articulate what we value or what we want to see, like our vision or... as a poet, I'm trying to think of like the poet revolutionary, how we can use language that way. So if there are too many words, we need to make these our words. We need to put our meanings on the table in these words and invent words that can shape the world the way we want it to shape. I mean, I find this very inspirational, actually, because a lot of times... As a writer, I feel like somewhat marginalized in political activism. It's just like, oh, you're doing nothing? You're sitting at home writing a book. Like, that's not really doing anything.
Right.
And so, to me, it's much more exciting to think, well,
that is
the poets are not the leaders, because I don't, you know, like, it shouldn't be like a vanguard of, and we're all, like, everyone just, we're just poets, that will be enough. But like, it's exciting to think that this work is... somehow fostering this breakdown in communication. Like, so the breakdown in communication is a good thing, right? Because it's what's going to kind of bring down the structures that are in place,
mm-hmm.
that are kept there by this presumed shared language, which we don't actually have.
Right.
Well, that was a bit of a rant.
Me too, but it sort of seems like the breakdown in communication is coming through a situation in the world, and that creates an opening. And he sort of reserves for poets the... this creative function of making new language within the space of that breakdown of communication. And then, like, you know, other aspects of society grab on to that creative work, which you sort of see now where creative work of redefining liberty and freedom is grabbed onto by, you know, I mean, there's people who are poets,
arguably,
who are working in PR firms, you know, who are, like, coming up with new language and new terms, and then, you know, the political system is grabbing onto that creation of language. But, yeah, within the breakdown of communication, there's the place for redefining what is the world, and that actually affects the whole language and the whole idea of reality. I have one question for everybody that sort of points to. I'm wondering, maybe we can even just go around really quick if that's all right, but I'm wondering, what are people's definition of revolution? And if you don't want to go around, I can explain why I have that question. I'm wondering if the right wing can have a revolution, if we feel like the right wing can have a revolution, or if we feel like a revolution is strictly to preserve of a progressive tendency, you know.
But that's too... I'd love to hear what people think. I think that's a bit of a red baiting question.
Red baiting question.
Like it's too like you can just say yes or no.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
The right can't have a revolution. Like it's too simplistic.
Yeah.
I want to hear what people think is revolution. Do you want to do that?
Sure.
Okay.
Both.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, who wants
to respond to both of those? Take that. Right
now.
I don't know what revolution is. Revolution, I think, is a really problematic term. Maybe not really the term itself, just how it's being taken up. Like people always, we were talking earlier about the revolutionary subject and what creates a revolution. I'm like, well, show me first a successful revolution, and actually show me a revolution. Like, I don't know that anyone actually knows what it is. It's one of those words like democracy that we were talking about earlier. Big container that means so many different things. That being said, I'm going to contradict myself and say that, yeah, the right can have a revolution. I think maybe the problem I have is that we talk about ourselves as revolutionaries, but people who come to this kind of thing and whatever talk about this kind of thing strike me more as counter-revolutionaries. Because the majority of the history of the world, people kind of lived, and living things lived very equally and whatever, and there were balanced systems. And at some point, a minority came along and said, okay, well, property. And you get this, and you get this, and you don't. And that was a revolution. And so I think we need to stop thinking of ourselves as revolutionaries and counter-revolutionaries. We need to stop the attack on something that's working very well for everyone for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just my thing on revolution.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's great too, because, you know, I mean, when you talk about all these other societies or other traditions, I mean, you forget sometimes that, you know, we're very happy to see that many of them were more egalitarian than ours is now, or whatever you want to say without getting called a romanticizer, but but this culture emerged out of those ones as well. And so it is sort of like, you're right, we want to be original or revolutionary in the sense that we want to go back to the origin, we want to go back to the way things were in a sense, and undo this thing that has emerged, but we also can't really, because this has come out of it. I mean, we live in a culture that's emerged from all these more sort of egalitarian, so we have to find a way to incorporate all the damage that's been done into it, and that is a sort of revolution too. And a combination of these two ways of being.
Yeah, I don't want to say that I'm like, let's all go back to the hunter-gatherers or something. I like being able to see, which civilization gave me eyeglasses and stuff like that. It's part of this global system. So words like revolution, counter-revolution, you can't actually have either, but there's still something to aim for. It's like putting your values on the table. Like you said, you create words and then you kind of aim for that. And it's just creating a space for movement.
Anyone else?
Revolutions are take place in a geography, like they take place in space and time. And I think that the geography of revolutions is pretty is something that I guess should be studied or is interesting. So I was thinking about what does land have to do with revolutions,
uh-huh.
and the Industrial Revolution specifically. You know,
kind of like asking the question of like, can the right have a revolution? I'm tempted to say yes. Because it seems like, I'm not trying to like present what I'm about to say as like what a revolution is or has to be or whatever, and it's probably going to sound way too derived from Marx anyway, but like it's kind of like, it seems like if there's like an overthrow of like a dominant like power structure, like, well, rather not so much a power structure, like an ideology. Like, I mean, like, if you look, I mean, like, I'm going to point to, like, the European fascism as a revolution because it was so squarely positioned against the liberal democracy that had been in the works since the 1700s, like, since the late 1700s. And it was a complete rejection of, like, the notion of really strong individual rights and freedom. And even though it kept the means of production intact, and that's where I kind of like, maybe it's not too weight, it's not so much Marxist, but like, because it kept the means of production intact, but the ideology behind it all was completely discarded. And kind of like, I feel like that qualifies it as a revolution. And I think that's, I think that's a really good example of a right-wing revolution. Like, even though it didn't necessarily like destroy the means of production, it really shifted the ideology, which basically shifts everything about a culture, I feel like. I think, at least.
You have a background idea that a revolution is supposed to destroy the existing means of production and make a new means of production?
Well,
you keep referring to the Nazis kept the means of production.
Well, I mean, like, they kept...
Why
is
that significant?
Because a lot of revolutionary tradition and, like, a lot of revolutionary thought has its roots from a lot of Marxist thought. And Marx is really big on destroying the means of production, creating new means of production, overthrowing old means of production,
mm-hmm.
but in more like a purely economic sense.
Right.
And I mean, I know you can read Marx differently and apply his ideas to like ideology and stuff like that. So I'm just saying that I'm trying to, like I said, that it was probably going to seem overly Marxist what I was trying to say, but then kind of like separating from, just because Marx is so influential, I feel like it's necessary to reference him a lot when talking about revolutionary,
sure.
like theories and stuff. And so, but I'm just saying that moving away from like the Marxist idea that has to be like the means of production, like capitalist wage labor, division of labor, all that fun stuff,
but well, fun. But
you should cut it when you want to.
Can
it's
I
a conversation.
In?
Yeah.
Like I don't like interrupting it. People though. So
if when it feels alright, if it feels okay.
I am totally going to disagree with both of you and say that like I really like this here. Revolution involves a change in structure, but a change in structure is not a revolution. Like a change in structure that puts people into more oppressed organizations is not a revolution. A revolution is about liberation. It's about freeing ourselves from some kind of exploitation or revolution. I mean, or exploitation or oppression, or like it's about changing socially organized relationships. It's about changing the means of production. I don't think the right can have a revolution at all, because it's if the capitalists are just becoming worse capitalists, that's not revolutionary at all. That's just more of the same shit. And it's the same structure, and maybe it's just changed a little. Like, to me, the Industrial Revolution is not a revolution. That was just, like, a new way of exploiting people.
Okay.
So I feel pretty strong about this, obviously.
You know, what's interesting, too, is that your reaction to the word revolution and revolutionary, it comes, like, from all kinds of, like, a symbolic history. There's anger, there's emotion, and we haven't actually talked about the word, like
mm-hmm.
revolution. What does it mean to revolve,
mm-hmm.
right? It means to move.
Right. It means to come back.
It moves,
it means to return to a point.
And to come back to a point. But...
it also means that's moving forward.
Right.
Well, if
yeah.
you talk about, like, Hannah Arendt and
so
her book on revolution,
yeah.
right? That's what... But she says that it's not just about getting rid of the old system. It's about grounding a whole new freedom, a grounding of a new freedom, which is determined by the people who are going to be then practicing that freedom or that liberation in their lives. So, sure, getting rid of the structures is important, but you can't just do that. You also then have to follow that up with, like, how do we now organize ourselves? And it's not, I don't think it's two discrete things. Okay, we've got rid of the capitalists, let's now sit down and organize. Like, I think it kind of happens together, but it's two parts.
Can I ask something else, too? About, just to add, tack on to the question of what we think about and what we think the word revolution means. Can revolution be anything other than political? Right? Because when I'm reflecting about just the word revolution, I'm thinking revolution. What does revolution mean? It seems to me that it's a movement out of a stillness. So whatever structure is in place, and that includes political, economic, language,
yeah.
physical, cultural, whatever that has that has somehow plateaued in a way. And we all become really comfortable with that system, whatever kind of system it is, including systems of thought, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, okay, as soon as you can be still, then you start thinking. And then you start thinking and thinking and thinking. Because as long as you're moving, you're doing something, you're acting, you're working towards a goal, you're figuring shit out, whatever. But as soon as you sit still and you start reflecting, whatever comes from that thought, from the stillness, leads to revolution. So it's very often political, but it could also be intellectual, it could also be emotional, personal. It could be a personal emotional revolution in your own life. Like, you have a lifespan and you go through these periods of stillness, right? And then you go through action, and then from that you come back to, you know, a certain kind of stability perhaps, and you start thinking again, because we're always thinking, right?
Yeah.
That's what we do. And then you have another revolution.
Sorry, if I could just jump in. For me, it seems that the meaning of the word revolution is kind of like completely uninteresting to me. But our relationship to the word revolution
mm-hmm.
seems to be really the crux of the question. It's not what the word means, it's what that word means to us. And we started this conversation by talking about how we create our world, and we do this through language, and through being a word to stand in for words like, you know, tool or you know, all these other kinds of ways of describing that relationship between the world and the language that we use to describe it. But through that process, we come to this word revolution. And so I think it's really that process. It's really that process of asking ourselves, what does revolution mean? And so when it starts to come to mean all of these things about, like, yeah, like, taking down the capitalists, that's revolution. Like, making a world where we're not pissed we have to live in it, you know? Like, these kinds of relationships that a lot of people, especially here, have to the word revolution, I think are actually just way more important than what revolution means. As long as, like, we kind of come here and have this, like, idea of, you know, this kind of common idea, not to say that it would mean the same thing to us all, but to say that our ideas of the word are what's more important than any kind of independent meaning.
Maybe, but then maybe we're just having a field of revival that has nothing to do with creating, like, any kind of organization. If your definition of revolution implies some kind of social cooperation or some kind of social organization, then without reaching any kind of commonality of meaning, doesn't that leave you nowhere?
Well, for me, it's not... I'm not asking the word revolution to take me anywhere. I'm going, and the word revolution is coming or not.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. That's nice.
There's, I have a slight wariness of the term, and I certainly hope it doesn't sound jaded, maybe it does, that some people, probably not anyone here, have this idea of revolution. We're like, okay, well, when it happens, you know, I'm waiting for it, and I'm a revolutionary, and it isn't that sexy, and when it happens, but what the hell did you do today? You know, I mean, that's a real simple way to, simple point.
Well, that's embodied, that's sort of summed up in the whole idea of post-apocalyptic anarchism, which other people have given talks about, that, you know, this millennial idea of revolution that we're waiting for,
yeah,
the day.
Yeah, just where it becomes this abstract thing that's over here, and my life is over here, and, like, I like to look at that, I don't have to feel good about myself, but,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if I can confess, like, I know that I obsess about this word revolution, because I was one of those little kids who was always told about the revolution when I was a little kid, you know, and, like, they would read, my dad used to read the revolution, it's ladies and gentlemen of the jury, are not made by man, but are the natural outcome of the impact of conflicting historical forces. You know, like,
bedtime
like,
stories?
Yeah,
that's
nobody else has to
deal
with that?
No.
Bedtime
stories
are
all about
capitalism. Oh, I don't know about Trotsky and about, like, Lenin betraying Trotsky.
Those are your fairy tales?
Yeah, about going to Mexico.
That makes me want to have kids. That sounds like so much fun.
But to go back to a few points that sort of came up and see if we can, but so I know that that's part of why I think about this word all the time, you know,
cool.
Like I'm working it out, you know, other people are working out their parents being Christian.
I can't.
Or Jewish or whatever, you know. But so one thing is you were talking about the relation between, like you were talking about revolution as a movement to, and with a sort of affinity of the word revolve. And actually, that's the word revolve lends itself to the idea of revolution as going nowhere, as just being an eternal cycle. But the etymologically, revolution does not come from revolve; it comes from revolt, which simply means to turn over.
Okay.
You know, so like you rise up and you turn over the existing order of things, and those on the top go to the bottom. Which revolt lends itself to this very Christian idea of the meek shall inherit the earth. You know,
if you revolve enough times, you are. You
but
are
it still becomes
right.
A certain
yeah.
cycle, right? That's
you're not
going to
flip
right.
something over and then, oh, it's done.
No, but then it
now
it's
static and we're all happy
right.
and perfect. Like, you're eventually going to have to flip it over again.
Again and again.
It's
again.
Like, it's like
yeah.
a futon.
Which
you don't want it to get
all
flat. You keep flipping it over and over. Well, that's like the Thomas Jefferson quote.
The way the earth has to be continually
turned
over in order to make it fresh. So that it's relevant to the people who are living there.
Right.
Must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of
patriots. Yeah. Revolution is always unfinished. I mean, in this whole idea, revolution is always an unfinished project. You know, it's always.
But that's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
That gives power to the people who are living today. It's not like, oh, well, my grandparents had a revolution. I can sleep.
Yeah.
I just have a long
nap. I think our bodies too are really drawn to this circular sense, though, and not just a revolve and turning things over. I mean. Like that, you know, I mean, we are always embedded in cycles, and we are ourselves physically embedded in cycles as well, and I don't think that it's Right, so I mean this idea that we can achieve something that's lasting in that way of just turning it over, like you said. I mean it just doesn't happen like that, because it's not even how physically that we work or physically how the world works.
What do you mean?
Well,
can anybody restate what you just said?
I can restate it.
It's
that.
Restate
to me,
okay.
I mean, wait. Oh, sorry. I mean, I just said what you said makes sense. A lot of sense to me. So, I agree with him.
Can you? We can just leave something be once it flips over. Like, as humans, our human nature is to be a part of a perpetual cycle of death, birth, rebirth. Like all this, you know, the clouds, the like everything in what we are is, you know, like. Everything is a cycle for us, and so revolution therefore can't just be like, well, we're just gonna, you know, make black white and leave it be. Like, it's gonna have to come back full circle again, over and over and over and over and over again, just as our lives do every day. And that's how I
you're much clearer than I am.
I think one useful way for me of thinking about revolution is as a consistent and perpetual process of creation and destruction, with the inevitable reemergence of forces of domination. So there's this constant sense that there will be domination, and that one must constantly be involved both internally and externally in destroying that and trying to create alternatives which inevitably will, you know, be subjected to new forms of domination. That again must be destroyed.
Can I interject real quick with two sort of things? And then, one thing is this sort of what you guys are talking about, this opposition you're talking about, actually hasn't gotten us beyond Soviet revolutionary theory, which was about the dichotomy between perpetual and permanent revolution. And we haven't even entered a sort of anarchist idea of revolution yet, if we're just talking in those terms, which is the permanent revolution, which was the idea that the Soviet Union was founded on, ultimately after Stalin came to power, is that revolution happens in a place, and then revolution is permanent, and the new order, the proletariat is in power, and the revolution is completed. And Trotsky was ejected for the idea of perpetual revolution, which is simply that the revolution has to go out. You know, the Bolshevik must always be a revolutionary party that's waging revolution against any existing power structure, including the army or, you know, whoever comes into power from any revolutionary moment. And that was. That's the dichotomy of perpetual and permanent.
Well, that's my question too with the idea of domination. Do any of us here believe, like, let's say we have a revolution, are we going to be dominating? Like, what does that mean for you if you include the issue of power and domination within revolution, right? Does that mean that there is always going to be some form of domination?
If we're rooting the idea of revolution in some sort of like natural history, like you were talking about, that like our idea of revolution is somehow based in natural forces inherent in our bodies or in nature at large, that kind of presuppose it, this cyclical nature of re-evolution all the time, then this is my train of thought.
Do you need a minute?
Yeah.
Right.
One thing that I thought was kind of interesting, I don't remember who said, but we were talking about like the root of the word revolution and revolt. Was that you?
Yeah.
Okay, and then you described like you push something over, and then you said that the people at the top are at the bottom now, which kind of, and I don't know if you said it or if it just implied that the people at the bottom are at the top now, and like I think that's a really interesting way of phrasing it, like. Just because, like, that makes there be, a hierarchy, like...
Yeah.
Like, I just think that's a really, like,
yeah.
interesting way with really weird implications of, like, the notion of, like, revolution as just, like, pushing, like, just switching power structures, switching people in power, and, like... And, I don't know, does that, like, just, like, kind of make the term revolution not worthwhile for anarchists anymore?
Right,
like,
so that definition of revolution is...
I just think that's a kind of interesting thing to consider, like, if it's just going to be perpetually... And, like, you were talking about, like, just perpetually putting power structures and always fighting against them, but, like... And then, like, is there, like, something that we... Is there a way to, like, discard the term revolution and, like,
mm-hmm.
move on to, like... I mean, I wouldn't, like, I can't even, like... I can't even like think of what it would be, but like, I mean, kind of like moving beyond like this, just like top bottom, top bottom, top bottom, top bottom thing.
If we're talking about the definition of words, then can't we say that a revolution in the terms of what we're talking about theoretically isn't going from, you know, turning the huge triangle that we have of society upside down, but just kind of manipulating the shape and all of a sudden becoming this flat line of just everybody being an equal plane or like a circle or some other sort of shape or some sort of like idea of how we have our society kind of, I had the perfect term for it, but of course I've
but like horizontalism, like
yeah.
a horizontalist idea.
Instead of, you know,
or a rhizomatic network.
Yeah, it's not the turning over or the kind of, it's an upheaval, it's a total change, it's complete whatever.
A complete whatever. That's the thing that's so exciting about words like revolution, but also words like heaven, you know?
Yeah.
They're like a complete whatever. And, you know, what are we going
to...
We...
So this is exciting because what it means is we have to be able to conceptualize human social relationships without domination. I mean, that's like at the root of it all. And... that's hard.
And
I mean, we need to invent so many new words to
yeah.
talk about that.
Yeah. And is revolution maybe not a good word for that purpose?
I mean, if what we're talking about is just like flipping over things a lot of times and just keeping on doing that, it's like I don't remember the Greek myth, but like pushing the rock up the hill,
Sisyphus,
like pushing the rock up the hill, rolling back down, pushing the rock up the hill, rolling back down. Like, what is it? Like, is that what we're doing, or are we, like, going to...
I'm...
Oh, that's a great one. You mean the ladder?
Brooklyn.
What?
I can't quote it. I read it in high school.
The golden ball? The
no,
Lord
no,
makes
it was
the ladder
Stephen Crane. It was many workmen,
uh-huh.
and they built a huge ball of masonry, and they pushed it up the hill, and it rolled back upon them, and
wow.
a few of them had opportunity to squeal. That's the gist of it. But when I was, you know, I'm 18, I'm like, yeah.
Well, that's like the atom bomb, right?
Yeah.
You know? Like,
See what? Same word?
It's like the atom bomb. A ball of, so all these people, they work to create something and destroy them all. And like,
yeah.
some of them got to express something before they got killed.
Destroyed a lot of other people.
Yeah, didn't destroy the people who,
yeah.
Isn't a complete thought, it's more of a question or putting something out there, but I'm thinking as we're talking that we're talking in turn like about where direction fits into it and how that enters into our thought. And I think I was thinking about that when you're talking about is there some other possibility than an up and a down almost, and when you're talking about moving something into a line. And then I liked what you said about the rhizome, that almost can revolution happen in all sorts of, just the idea of direction, can it happen that maybe it's not just happening in one set.
Yeah.
Just something about the idea of things actually going off all over the place, that there's up and down and...
like an explosion?
Sure.
I mean, that's just, like, the imagery that comes to mind with, like, something just kind of, like, just blowing, like...
But the thing about an explosion is it has to come from one place
exactly.
and then goes outwards,
right.
whereas there's many explosions maybe that happen all over
cluster
the place.
Bombs.
or the formation of ice crystals or something. I mean, those are like many little small explosions that kind of, I don't know what the word is, but crystallize.
I think there's some...
Did you
figure your thought out?
Yeah, I would just, back to the idea that you guys were referring to of rooting revolution in kind of natural forces of perpetual change in natural history, that and then the idea of there has to be a dominant force to be overcome, is that projecting human constructed ideas into natural processes and in that case then is revolution in the way that people conceive of it a totally human it has to be then a human constructed idea if it presupposes a dominant or a powerful source, because that's something arguably that doesn't exist outside of human society.
Yeah, it's an attempt to dominate an enemy, and it goes back to what you said. Well, we need to, this is great because we need to think of We need to think of a completely non-hierarchical way of life, right? But that way of life is already presented to us by the natural world, which has distinctions, but not enemies. They're, you know, if an animal eats another animal, they're not enemies, they're not dominating. They live in accordance with one another. And that's, we can look at distinctions in our own lives and in our relations to other people without trying to have one distinction be more powerful or overwhelm or dominate the other distinction. We can understand roles, we can understand status without just deferring to hierarchy every single time.
So then
but what if you don't want to be eaten by the other animal?
It's too bad.
Run!
It's too bad. Where are you going to go? You're going to be eaten by bacteria.
You have to make room for your child.
Yeah.
So does this revolution exist outside of human social relations? Can it exist in nature?
We don't even know how we're defining. We've got
many
different definitions of revolution as we've got people in the room.
And we've just got enemy in here. Like, enemy is a whole other word. Like, and you define revolution as an act against your enemy, and so then there's no distinction in between revolution and war? Or I'm confused now. Like, enemy is, like, really...
Well, an enemy is, like, someone, something, theoretically, that's, like, this outside power. Like, if you think about two, you know, the United States and their enemy, the terrorists. And but a revolution isn't, it's not like power over, it's kind of coming from power from within.
Right.
It's like rising up, that whole idea of like of turning things over, of starting anew, of, as opposed to like suppression, and as you were talking about a long time ago. But I feel like that almost ignores some of the things that we were talking about before, but it's like, it's not condensing things, it's kind of making things get bigger. So,
like, I don't understand what you mean by enemy and how it relates to revolution and how revolution can be distinguishable from war at all. And I don't understand what you mean by in nature there is no enemy. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen when a bunch of songbirds will get together to attack a cat, if they see a cat coming near, like, where there's, like, young songbirds, and, like, they will get in a pack and they will... They're just like airplanes, like going down, swooping, and chasing the cat
like
out of where they are.
But once
it's a momentary enemy, but that's definitely like a little micro war right there.
But
that's
momentary. It's momentary.
Yeah.
Once that's over, they
don't start chasing
it doesn't continue
cats.
As a political relationship,
right.
And they don't try to dominate other cats using
right.
it as a scapegoat.
Right.
Or
whatever. It doesn't extend into abstraction. I mean,
right.
It's different. This is and that's a cyclical thing. I mean, it goes back to the idea of something. I mean, being cyclical.
Yeah.
I think the enemy is something that's based more on ideology and principle and abstraction rather than actual physical
mm-hmm.
opposition.
So basically, revolution, then, if you're equating it with enemy, is just a form of internal war. It's like the idea that your rulers are your enemy, and so you've internalized war and you declared war upon your own social body. Is that all it is?
I'll accept that right now.
In that sense, you're not trying to convert the entire world to have equal social relations. You've already like said, well, these people are excluded from that, the possibility of that, because they have a tendency to dominate. So
right.
We have to kill them all, or
which you have the terror.
Like,
the terror is that, right? I don't mean now. I mean in France, you know, like basically the nobility is the enemy. We're going to kill them all.
Or
yeah,
cultural
like,
revolution
yeah.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but then they just got the bourgeois ruling thing. So like then, you know, it's...
That's what revolutions are. That's what happens every single time. There's always going to be someone else filling in, you know, moving in to fill the void. It's like it goes, you can't blow up a social relationship.
But what
if
is
you
that?
Try to do it by force rather than conceptually, you're always going to get someone dominating because they've made people stop living the way they wanted to.
But conceptually, you also get people dominating. Like we're dominated by whatever, America... Sorry, not American, but other kinds of ideologies.
Including
American ideologies, whatever, whoever. Like, there's lots of dominant ideologies in the world right now, which are not necessarily mutual aid or, like, equal social relationships or whatever, trust or...
But maybe one way to reframe this notion of the enemy is the predator or the parasite, which is an aggressive dominating force that will destroy any rhizomatic network and that does in fact need to be held accountable through either concept, force, will, discussion. I mean, there is such a thing. There are material moments where people are bombed. There are physically people dying around the world because of American imperialism. It isn't simply an abstract notion of domination. A corporate power does, in fact, pay people completely obscene wages for, you know, stealing their life. And those are real, real things. And those forces of domination do in some way need to be taken into account in thinking about reorganizing social networks. I mean, it appears from the example of the Russian Revolution when there was this moment where people came together and they said, you know, yes to the idea of worker-run collectives and cooperatives through, you know, the Ukrainian peasants, all these different people gathering together. And what happens? There's a party consolidation. There is a desire to co-opt those forces. There is coercion. And without thinking about domination as, or, you know, people preying on others, all that work is lost.
But to conflate that with predator, with the term predator, or to put enemy on what goes on in nature is really, really dangerous. Predators are really important. Prey are really important. That relationship is what makes all of this happen. Without the constant preying upon things, we wouldn't be breathing, eating, we wouldn't be able to do what we do. I mean, when we think about, well, that's an enemy relationship when they attack that cat or whatever, that's really loaded, because that goes back to, like, survival of the fittest, right? Like, that's mm-hmm. a loaded term. Everyone's heard mm-hmm. that nature is survival of the fittest, which it really isn't, like, the way that it's conceived of, you know? And it goes back to language. Like, if we think of predators as a bad thing, if we call them predators, in a way we're actually helping them, because predators exist in nature and it links them to this kind of force that we just can't do away with. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's a problem from a lot of different angles. Like, I agree with everything you said after that, but to conflate it with predators, it's just like, it means both that we're insulting what's going on in nature and yet at the same time giving them, our quote-unquote enemies, the real ones, the powerful, this sense of endlessness and kind of a natural force. Mm-hmm.
But what is the value of distinguishing ourselves so thoroughly from nature that we can't use those terms? I mean, there are moments where...
It's a misuse of the term predator. It's a mm-hmm. misuse of the word enemy, I think. And we're anthropomorphizing our society's lens over how animals interact. Mm-hmm. And like, yeah, they will hunt each other, they will do horrible, gruesome things to each other, but they will never try to wipe out another population.
It's because he said that one civilization came and ate another.
But that's not, I think that there's a difference. We don't have to segregate ourselves from nature to notice that there's a difference in the quality of a corporation exploding its workers and a tiger eating a deer. I mean, we can see that there's an actual difference in quality between those two things. So
why?
What is
Sorry?
It? Yeah, what is that difference?
Well, the tiger is doing it because it needs to sustain its physical self, its body, as
like
something that is much linked to a material world. The corporation is doing it to sustain its abstract self. This is something much different. It's exploiting physically to sustain an abstraction. And I think that that's to sustain an ideology. I mean, I think that there's this, and this is this, this idea that, I agree with what you say. If we segregate ourselves from nature, I mean, it's completely bizarre, right? Because you're equating this with nature, and yet you're segregating at the same time, right? So it just becomes contradictory in a way. I think that there's a difference in quality, and that abstract exploitation is something we should work on, or the need to sustain an abstraction is something that we should work on. It's something we can work on with language. I mean, very well, because language itself is a system of very ordered abstractions.
Like
top of the food chain, for instance, that's a really loaded term. There is no top of the food chain. It's even self-contradictory. Think of a chain. Where's the top of the chain? Like, it doesn't work that way. But we think of ourselves as the top of the food chain, which is ridiculous. And the difference between corporation dominating and a tiger eating its prey is corporation, like, the analogy would be a bunch of tigers get together and plot to wipe out an entire,
population or something. Not in the word, like, but were you using predator, like, in Trudell's sense of predator?
I'm not sure. Maybe.
Are you guys familiar with John Trudell? Or, like, you all know, what's his name? The other
War
guy.
Churchill?
Yeah, War Churchill. Yeah. Well, Predator came from a poem. It came from a poem by John Trudell. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's this idea that, like, you know, European civilization needed to consume something, you know? And, like, it wasn't that there was some evil.